We're on. So, I'm doing a talk today on a koan. And the sort of punchline is ordinary mind is the way. I live in Sechelt, and I belong to a Zen book club there. And we are currently reading and discussing a book about koans. It is called Bring Me the Rhinoceros, and that's actually one of the koans in there. It's written by John Tarrant, who is a Zen teacher and a Dharma heir of the late Robert Aiken. In this book, Tarrant offers, he's chosen 15 koans and talks about how to work with them, maybe discussing some insights as to what he thinks they're trying to convey. He shares stories from his own life, as well as how some people have worked with a particular koan. And this is from the beginning of the introduction. Koans are not intended to prescribe a particular kind of happiness or right way to live. They don't teach you to assemble or make something that didn't exist before. Many psychological and spiritual approaches rely on an engineering metaphor and hope to make your mind more predictable and controllable. Koans go the other way. They encourage you to make an ally of the unpredictability of the mind and to approach your life more as a work of art. The surprise they offer is the one that art offers. Inside unpredictability, you will find not chaos, but beauty. Koans light up a life that may have been dormant in you. They hold out the possibility of transformation, even if you're trying to address unclear or apparently insoluble problems. And just a word about koan practice, both Soto, which is us, and Rinzai schools, which is the other major school of Zen, we both study koans, but differently. Rinzai practitioners are given a koan to work with. They actually sit with a koan, and then they go to their teacher, and once they've given a satisfactory explanation to the koan, they're given another one, and they work through a series of koans that way. In Soto Zen, which is, again, us, our main practice is Zazen, just sitting. We study the koans mostly through talks, reading, and discussion. And it's not to say that one can't sit with the koan, it's just not our main practice. So on to the koan. I chose a well-known koan that some, maybe quite a few of you, have heard before. Ordinary mind is the way. I believe it is considered one of the more straightforward koans. And even though I have heard this koan quite often, being repeated, something in this koan spoke to me and seemed important when I encountered it again this time. And when I decided to talk about this particular koan, I listened to a talk by Norman Fisher, who is the guiding teacher for this sangha. And he reminded his listeners that he actually, that's where he got the name for his online sangha, Everyday Zen. It's actually from this koan, and he translates ordinary as everyday. So I'll use both these terms interchangeably during this talk. So this koan, Everyday Mind is the Way, is also used when we have a ceremony called Hosen Shiki, which is a ceremony we have at the end of our practice period in the fall, and when we have a shuso or head monk. And we will have shuso this fall, so we will be doing the ceremony, and this koan will be recited at that point. So here is the koan. Zhao Zhou asked Nanchuan, "What is the way?" Nanchuan said, "Ordinary mind is the way. Should I turn toward it or not? If you turn toward it, you turn away from it." Zhao Zhou asked, "How can I know the way if I don't turn toward it?" Nanchuan said, "The way is not about knowing or not knowing. When you know something, you are deluded. And when you don't know, you are just empty-headed. When you reach the way beyond doubt, it is vast and infinite as space. You can't say it's right or wrong. With these words, Jiaozhou had sudden understanding. So some background on the characters here. Jiaozhou lived in the 8th century AD. He ordained as a monk at a young age and met Nanchuan, his teacher. And they stayed together. He stayed with Nanchuan until his teacher died. After his Nanchuan's death, Jiaozhou then traveled through China, visiting prominent Chan teachers. And Chan is just the Chinese word. It means the same thing as Zen. So he traveled around China until the age of 80. And then he settled in a ruined temple in northern China. Only then did he start teaching a small group of monks for the next 40 years or so, until his death at the age of 118 or 119. When I first heard this, I thought, no way. But I saw it on Wikipedia too, so it must be true. Jiaozhou is well known for his paradoxical statements and strange deeds, but he is also remembered for everyday conversation and his gentle, quiet nature. Unlike others and teachers of that era, he did not shout or beat his students with a stick. And as John Terrence says in his book, he was terrific at conveying the beauty of ordinariness. So the story goes that Jiaozhou was a young monk when he asked this question of his teacher. From what I understand, he was struggling with his practice and wanted help. He was basically asking, what is the truth or ultimate reality and how do I realize it? And this might be something that most of us can relate to, as we might have similar questions that we ponder, like, what is life? What is this all about? How do I practice? Even, how can I be happy? The answer to his question may have been a shock to Jiaozhou when Nanchuan asserts, ordinary mind is the way. And here is what Tarrant has to say about ordinariness. If freedom, love, beauty, grace, and whatever else is desirable are to appear and endure, they will have to be found in ordinary circumstances, since ordinary circumstances fill most of life. The marvelous, the lovely, will have to be right here in the room where someone is reading, someone is sick, someone is coughing, two people are making love, or a man is yelling at a dog. It will have to appear in the sound of rain splashing off trees, of a truck laboring up a grade, of TV from another room. It will have to appear in the sight of a child running, in the feeling of a headache, in the anxiety of preparing for exams, in worrying over a sick child. It will have to appear in what is ordinary, usual, commonplace, and right under your nose. Here is a koan about the heaven of the ordinary. Many of us come to practice because of problems or difficulties in our life. Maybe we just want more peace of mind. We are so caught by our minds with endless thinking and caught by our emotions of anger, jealousy, resentment, greed, etc. In fact, when we first start practicing, we really become aware of the negative power of our minds that can create such misery for us. And for anyone who has sat a retreat for several days in a row, you will surely have experienced how the mind can drive us pretty crazy. We may have the attitude that our ordinary mind is the problem, and we're trying to find some relief from it, maybe even trying to get away from it. This koan is suggesting otherwise. A man is driving in Ireland. He wants to go to Dublin, but he's lost. He sees a farmer standing near the side of the road, and he stops to ask for directions. So you want to go to Dublin? Well, you could... No. Another way would be... No. After more starts and stops, the farmer finally says, "If I were going to Dublin, I wouldn't start from here." This is often how we feel about our own practice. We don't want to practice with this scattered, irritable, sleepy, bored, ordinary mind. We want a mind that is calmer, more concentrated, more devoted. But we are this body and mind. Practicing Zazen is to be this body, to be this mind. It is right in the midst of our resistance, our holding back, our yearning for it to be different, that we discover that it is exactly where life is happening and what is happening. So, our challenge is to learn to open and release into just this ordinary, everyday mind, just what is happening right now. So we need to learn to trust our bodies and minds. Another misconception is that practice is all about being calm, peaceful, and concentrated in order to have insights or spiritual experiences. Maybe we think those sublime, otherworldly states are somehow even the goal of practice. And it's so easy to be caught in this misconception. When I started meditating, I actually did believe that these sublime states was where it was at. And it probably didn't help that there was a strong emphasis on concentration in the Vipassana practice I was doing that can be accompanied often by calm, blissful states. One of the problems here is that one can get very hooked on having these experiences, which are very pleasant, which is probably an understatement, and then practice becomes all about having those experiences and mind states. This can become a real hindrance in practice. It certainly can cause a lot of suffering. So after practicing for many years, and long after I became a Zen student, I still found this belief coming up in my practice, that one needed to be concentrated and really calm for any kinds of realizations or insights to occur. That as far as the ordinary mind was concerned, it just got in the way. All that pesky thinking and getting carried away by emotions. Then I had a meeting with a Zen teacher during a 3-month practice period who told me in a way that I could hear that it wasn't about being really concentrated, it was about having some stability of the mind and then opening up to whatever was arising in the mind. And as I say this, it sounds so basic and commonsensical in terms of our sitting practice. But it's so easy to ignore what's right in front of us, our everyday mind, and want to transcend it for otherworldly, wonderful states. So ordinary, everyday mind is the way. Whatever is happening right now is the practice, is the truth. And there's a quote by Trungpa Rinpoche that I had taped on my bathroom mirror for some time. And it says, "If you don't find the truth where you are, where do you think you will find it?" So when Jiaozhou next asks his teacher, should I turn toward it or not? Nanchuan replies, if you turn toward it, you turn away from it. A typical, confusing Zen response. What does he mean by this? I really appreciate what Terence says about this in his interpretation of this meeting between Zen master Nanchuan and his student. Jiaozhou considered this. The teacher had a point, but it was a very frustrating point. Sometimes a young man would think he was meditating, but he wasn't really. He was trying to meditate. The trying seemed to be in the way. It was like learning to swim. If you thrash about too much, you sink. But if you stop thrashing about, you float. Yet he had no trust in his body's buoyancy. This line from the koan, if you turn toward it, you turn away from it, affected me deeply. And I can really relate to trying getting in the way. As some of you may know that I spent more than a year in a Burmese monastery, meditating from 3 a.m. till 9 p.m. every day with no days off. I was younger and very enthusiastic about meditation practice, in this case, Vipassana. I often describe my attitude as I would have crawled over broken glass to experience the tranquility and bliss that I had experienced earlier and to be successful in my practice. I was reaching for the lofty and sublime, or at least pleasant, and wasn't really paying attention to what was going on in my ordinary mind. I was trying really hard. But just as Zhaozhou says, he would think he was meditating, but he wasn't really. He was trying to meditate. So was I. I was trying to will myself to be a certain way or to have certain experiences. In my case, calmness and concentration. It so does not work this way. And it's taken me a long time to break that habit of trying to make something happen. Of course, the irony is that we do have to put some effort in our practice. You have to have some discipline or nothing much will change from our usual habits. If we just sat on our cushions and indulged in our thoughts and fantasies, we probably wouldn't find much benefit in Zazen. But when we try in the way that is referred to in the koan, it's too easy to try and reach a state or goal that we want or imagine we should be aspiring to. We're reaching for something that is outside of ourselves, rather than just being where we are and aware of whatever is coming up in the mind and body. This trying entails not accepting how things are right now. And that's a kind of aversion, something that I experienced a lot of those months in Burma, as well as frustration and anger. The funny thing is that I wasn't even really aware of those unpleasant emotions, at least initially, because I was trying so hard. And that also involved ignoring or repressing the painful emotions. Something that may have kept compounding the problem for me was whenever I had an interview with a teacher, at the end he would always say, "Please try harder." So I did. I know that he was trying to help me, but it was probably not the right kind of encouragement for me at the time. And I don't think I will ever say "try harder" to any meditation practitioner. Sometimes the expression "turning toward" is translated as "seek." And this may be helpful in understanding those lines. So those lines that I just mentioned would be, should I seek the way or not? If you seek it, you turn away from it. When we seek something, we're looking for something outside of ourselves. Rather than being here in this moment, we're looking elsewhere for relief, security, peace, wisdom, love, whatever. We're attempting to leapfrog over our boring, ordinary minds to get to the magic, the bliss, the razzle-dazzle. At the beginning of practice, it's not always so clear when we're trying too hard or reaching towards something. This can be quite subtle to appreciate, but over time, sitting with our crazy mind, we can see more and more readily the desiring mind that wants things in a certain way or wants a certain experience, and also the energy that's generated to try and get those things. Another way of looking at this is to see our effort in Zazen as a balance between too tight and being too loose, not too much effort, not too much effort and not slacking off, not trying too hard and not just getting lost in thoughts and fantasies. And the last part of the koan, Zhaozhou, how can I know the way if I don't turn towards it? Nanchuan, the way is not about knowing or not knowing. When you know something, you are deluded, and when you don't know, you are just empty-headed. When you reach the way beyond doubt, it is vast and infinite as space. You can't say it's right or wrong. The knowing here that Nanchuan is referring to is intellectual knowing, that which we understand with our minds. He's saying that spiritual wisdom or realization has nothing to do with intellectual understanding. Practice isn't about knowing. In fact, you could say that it's exactly the opposite, not knowing. Don't know mind is a familiar phrase in Zen. Suzuki Roshi, the founder of our particular lineage, also described this as beginner's mind, which is an attitude of meeting everything without judgment or preconceived ideas. We're encouraged to cultivate this in our practice. And it's usually something that we have to cultivate because our conditioning is so strong around wanting to know and own things and to try to figure things out. And I was thinking about this tendency to want to know, and I think it can come from a place of lack of security, at least sometimes. When we know something, it can feel or be a kind of power that maybe makes us feel like we have some control of our life, gives us confidence. But the problem is it can also reify the ego, that feeling of me and mine. We can get very attached to what we know and get identified with it and then think that's who we really are. Nanchuan is saying that this is a delusion. Don't know mind, or beginner's mind, allows us to be with things just as they are without having to figure them out or fix them. It's having trust in our bodies and our deepest nature. And finally, the phrase, you can't say it's right or wrong, because this place of emptiness or vast infinite space that he's talking about is beyond dualism. And dualism is the way we usually see or experience the world. It's right or wrong, good or bad, black or white, like or dislike. And we're always picking and choosing. We're always discriminating. The way, or reality with a capital R, is beyond these discriminations. As was pointed out earlier, you can't know this kind of truth, at least in the way we usually know anything. We chant the Heart Sutra regularly. It also tells us that the way is beyond the level of discrimination or perception or thinking. No eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no sight, no smell, no taste, no touch, no object of mind. Beyond all inverted views, one realizes nirvana. And although I've never analyzed inverted views, I would think it refers to the screwy way that we usually perceive the world and reality. The belief in myself as something solid and fixed that exists in a way that it really doesn't. Also, an inability to deeply see and appreciate impermanence fully. As I mentioned, we don't do formal koan practice in our Soto Zen practice, but we can actually use a koan in our sitting practice in the following way. Once your mind is stabilized, maybe after counting the breath and having some calmness, one can use the line, ordinary mind is the way, to repeat silently to oneself, and then just sit with that. Not with any idea in mind or expectation or to think about it. Just see what comes up, if anything. Let it permeate your being. To me, that phrase can be a reminder to come back to the basics of here and now. In the past 2 weeks, I've also repeated like a mantra when I remember to as I go about my day. Again, reminding myself of the wonder that is contained in all those mundane, everyday moments. Like when I wash dishes, walking upstairs, having a cup of tea, seeing a flower. It's a kind of grounding in reality, and to me, it reinforces that there's nothing that is missing or left out. Everything is contained in this ordinary, everyday moment. This is what we can practice with too. I'm going to close with a poem by the poet W.S. Merwin, who also was he was also a student of Eiken Roshi, as was Tarrant, the author of this book. He was Merwin was the American Poet Laureate a few years ago. And I have read this poem previously. The name of the poem is Gift. I have to trust what has been given to me if I am to trust anything. It led the stars over the shadowless mountain. What does it remember in its nights and silence? What does it not hope, knowing itself no child of time? What did it not begin? What will it not end? I have to hold it up in my hands as my ribs hold up my heart. Again in the mountain, I have to turn to the morning. I must be led by what was given to me, as streams are led by it, and braiding flights of birds. the gropings of veins, the learning of plants, the thankful days, breath by breath. I call to it, nameless one, O invisible, untouchable, free. I am nameless. I am undivided. I am invisible. I am untouchable and empty. Nomad, live with me. Be my eyes, my tongue and my hands, my sleep and my rising. Out of chaos, come and be given. Thank you for listening.